Okay, this is Yanni Chapman. Today is April 23rd. It's Thursday. And I'm beginning to record my autobiography. The focus will probably be mostly on my political development. And activities, but we are whole people, and so I don't think I can really separate that out from everything else about my life, and so we won't get a lot of information about my love relationships, or probably quite a few other things, but I certainly talk about a lot of personal things with my family and with my love of nature and friends and my health and a whole variety of issues, all the parts of my life that make me me. And I'm one who believes that the end is the beginning. It's the place we start from. Some famous person said that in the past. But it does make sense, because everything that we are is the result of our history. You know, we build from cell to cell and from experience to experience, and societies do the same thing. They build upon what's been done in the past, and the result is the present, and the present for me personally, and the present for our society. The present is our history, and that's a very important way of looking at things, because for the most part in our society, everybody's sort of trained and guided towards looking at things superficially and without looking at their historical development, just sort of on the surface. So much for a little bit of philosophy. Where shall we start? Let's see, I'm 62 years old. I am living in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which is a, for the most part, well-to-do college town where the University of North Carolina resides. And I have been living in this area, Chapel Hill, since about 1980, and lived in Pittsburgh from 1975 to 1980. That's about 15 miles south, a little town in Chatham County. And before that, I lived in Atlanta for about 4 years. And before that, I lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts when I was at Harvard, and living for a year after graduating in Cambridge. And before that, I lived my entire life in Shaker Heights, Ohio, a very wealthy, exclusive suburb of Cleveland. And we had a summer home in Madison, Ohio, which was about 45 miles east on Lake Erie. And I'll get to all those things after a while. But like I said, I'm 62. I am struggling with a chronic disease. It started off in 1980 called Polycythemia vera. And what it is a very rare and unknown origin disease of the blood and bone marrow that is a kind of cancer, but very manageable. And what happens is the bone marrow, for some reason, goes wild and starts producing too many blood cells. And so when it first presents itself, which it did for me at the beginning of 1980, your blood gets real thick because you're producing way too many red blood cells. And you're also producing too many platelets and too many white cells. But the thing that you really notice is the red blood cells, because it makes your blood really thick. And if it's untreated, you've got a good chance of dying within a year from a blood clot or from a bleeding incident. I discovered my situation because of a bleeding incident where I was a soccer player for fun. And I fell down, which was common, but then I got this huge bruise all the way from my hip down to my knee on one side, and it was purple and one of the most painful things I've ever endured. And it happened that I worked in a blood drawing lab at Memorial Hospital in Chapel Hill, and I immediately guessed that there was some kind of blood abnormality that was causing me to bleed like this and to bruise. And I checked out my blood and found out my hematocrit was really, really high in the 60s. And did a little research and decided I had polycythemia vera. Then I went to a bunch of hotshot doctors and they said I had polycythemia vera. So then started years and years of treatment, which have overall been quite successful at allowing me to live a fairly normal life. You know, as long as I endured various uncomfortable aspects of the disease, went through a period of years of violent itching. That was pretty bad. And then I went through years of really severe sores on my feet and ankles, and that was pretty bad. And then in the last 10 years, I've had to deal mostly with a enlarged spleen that's gotten to be a big problem and a tremendous amount of fatigue. So now the disease is no longer called polycythemia vera because it's reached the last stage of its development. And it's called post-polycythemic myeloid metaplasia. And in normal language, what that means is that the bone marrow has become so scarred that it doesn't really work very well, doesn't produce... The blood cells that are produced in there can't really move around the way they need to, and so they migrate out of the bone marrow and they settle on some other organs like the spleen or the liver, and then those get incredibly enlarged, and these cells produce fluid, and you get I get huge amounts of fluid in my abdomen, and I have a condition called portal hypertension, which cause things like varices, which could cause me to bleed to death. I got those pretty well treated and under control at this point. And I just had 4.8 or 6, something or another, liters drawn off of my abdomen yesterday, which is 10.5 pounds worth of fluid. So I'm actually feeling a little bit better. But this disease has entered what's called the spent phase, which is sort of a creepy name because it seems to indicate that my bone marrow is worn out. And basically that's pretty much the situation. And the blood counts that had been super high, like my hemoglobin and hematocrit, are now super low, and I have tremendous fatigue and various other problems. And we've run out of treatments that actually can, you know, keep the disease under control. And so I have pretty much two choices at this point in my life. One is to do nothing except try to just maintain as good health as I can. And that means having transfusions every couple of weeks and doing these abdominal drains and eating right and getting some exercise and living a good life. But what that means is just a likely slow decline for a number of months until I get to the point where I really can't survive. And the other choice is to have a somewhat risky operation called a splenectomy to take out that giant spleen, because apparently that's probably what's really gobbling up and destroying my red blood cells. Although maybe it's producing a lot of red blood cells too, I'm not sure. Nobody's totally sure about all this stuff. It's a very rare disease. But in any case, we take out the spleen and hope that that increases the red cell survival rate and that my hemoglobin and hematocrit come up and I don't have to have so many transfusions, and that the portal hypertension lessens, because the big spleen is part of causing that, and I don't have as much abdominal fluid and swelling in my legs, and I get an extension on life for who knows how long, but for some longer period of time than I would have if I don't do anything. And so that's the choice that I've made, and I really just made that choice for sure yesterday after consulting with my doctor and looking at my blood counts and considering the possibilities. So my plan is to wait until after my big beach trip, which every year I go to the beach at Topsail Beach with my family and a lot of my old comrades from Workers' Viewpoint Organization and the Communist Workers' Party, who have spread out all over the country and are doing all kinds of wonderful things with their lives. But we've been gathering at the beach every year for, I guess it's something like 30 years now. And this year, pretty much my whole family is going to be able to come, which is unusual. And so I'm not planning on missing that, but I'm going to have the surgery right after that. And like I said, it's fairly risky. There's a 10% chance or so of dying within the first month, and a higher chance of having some kind of nasty problems afterwards, but there's also a 50% chance of getting better. That's what I'm facing, and I'm trying to do some of the important things to wrap up what I really want to get accomplished in the time I have left. And one of those is to record, you know, do my own oral history, both for my kids and grandchildren, and also for political use, because I think I have a tremendous amount of experience that can be valuable to other people. So, besides being a sick guy, and a 62-year-old guy, white guy, grew up with privilege. I'm also, since high school, but especially since college, a completely devoted racial justice organizer, revolutionary in the sense that I believe that we have to transform our social system in ways that get beyond the bottom line being simply profit. It's not totally clear what kind of system that is. I used to think it was socialism. It may still be, but certainly not the kind of socialism that they had in the Soviet Union or in China. Something far more democratic. And we can talk about that more later. In any case, I've been here in Chapel Hill, like I said, for about 30 years now. I worked at the hospital for 10 years. I'm now the third vice president of the NAACP, Chapel Hill Carborough NAACP branch, and I'm head of the history committee of the NAACP, and I've been focusing my energies on recovering the history of the black community and black workers at the university, the whole history of black resistance to institutional racism in our community. And not just from an academic point of view, but from the point of view of movement building, popularizing this history so that really those who have been oppressed and exploited have a history that's, you know, reclaimed and in a form that's accessible and that's not simply dismissed or ignored in the typical Chapel Hill coffee table history books that just praise the southern part of heaven and the university of the people and a lot of white supremacists and liberal white people, and, you know, the history of black people is just mocked or ignored, censored. So that's why I went to graduate school in 1990, was to retrieve that history, and I wrote a master's thesis in 1995 on the origins of the civil rights movement in Chapel Hill, basically the role of black Lincoln High School students in bringing that struggle to fruition in 1960 through 1964 on the wake of the Greensboro A&T student sit-ins on February 1st, 1960. And then I followed that up with my dissertation completed in 2006 on black freedom and the University of North Carolina from 1793 to 1960. I would have gone further, but I ran out of time and my committee made me stop. But I've ever since I've lived here in Chapel Hill, I've been part of grassroots organizing efforts with workers at the university and the hospital, with welfare rights and tenant organizations during the 1970s and 80s, with the housekeepers movement during the 1990s especially. And as I said, increasingly I have focused on the cultural front, what I call the cultural front, which is mostly what I focus on is the sphere of history, honest history and commemoration, because the first step towards a just society and racial reconciliation is for us to acknowledge the inhumane and brutal and racist history that has characterized both Chapel Hill and the university. And it's essential that the institutions of the university and the town government and others fully acknowledge this history, repudiate the values that caused it, that guided it, the white supremacy values, the exploitation of workers, and also honor those who struggled against this kind of oppression and exploitation, which went through various stages in our area. One stage was slavery, from before the founding of the United States up through 1865 in Chapel Hill, when the Union cavalry came through and freed the slaves. And of course, we always have to put a strong emphasis on the fact that although it was the Union cavalry that came through and actually freed the slaves in Chapel Hill, that struggle, the Civil War and the aspect of it that led to the Emancipation Proclamation and freeing the slaves being a war aim, which was not there to begin with. All of this whole struggle was led by black people. It was led by black people in the South who were slaves or who may have been free, some of them, who struggled against the slave system, who ran away, who persevered in the face of injustice, who organized rebellions and revolts, and had their personal, you know, resistance, and simply survived the system to fight another day. And a lot of these slaves who escaped went to the northern U.S. or to Canada and continued to organize against slavery and helped found the abolitionist movement and were among the people who put pressure on Abraham Lincoln to enable African Americans to join the Union Army and to make emancipation a war aim. And then many of these same people came back to the South who had escaped during slavery or who had grown up free in the North to help try to reconstruct the South on a framework of justice and freedom and equality for African Americans. Let it never be said that black people in the United States have not been the ones to struggle for their own freedom and lead that struggle. Some of us, like myself, have been allies and supporters, as it should be, but we cannot make the mistake that many people have in the past, many white people in particular, of thinking that one of the big problems for African Americans is that they didn't free themselves, and that could not be further from the truth. Given, it's all complicated. And that's one of the reasons why I became a historian, was to understand the details of all this rather than just have a superficial grasp of things. So if we're starting from the end, thank you.